And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, the clown show continues. More and more senators are saying they're going to vote to acquit Trump. I mean, literally, he has not been accused of a crime. And the Constitution is very clear. President can be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors. Exercising of the prerogative of the presidency is not a high crime or a misdemeanor. Additionally, there are so many problems with the Democrats' case. For example, and I may have mentioned this, Schiff has sworn he does not know the identity of the whistleblower. However, the name of the whistleblower, Eric Ciamarelli, and the man who is dating his daughter are the same. And the man who's dating his daughter was appointed by Susan Rice, taken to the White House by H.R. McMaster's, and everyone believes that he, in fact, is the whistleblower. Well, how can Schiff say he doesn't know the identity of the whistleblower when the man is dating his daughter? I got an issue with that. Nadler is taken out for the tall timber. If he was so certain of what was going to happen, the impeachment is described as being an utter chaos. Well, I got some more information about a topic I'm doing a book on, which is Noah's Ark. Now, high above the Anatolian Plateau in eastern Turkey, and it's only a few miles from the borders of Iran and Russia, is a mountain. It's not among the world's highest. It's only 17,011 feet. But its name, of course, has long been the most famous among mountains. For thousands of years, that name has resonated throughout several major religions. The name is Ararat, site of the reputed landing of Noah's Ark. It's been part of Christian belief for 2,000 years, Judaic belief longer than that, Babylonian belief before that, Sumerian before it was Babylonian. Muslim tradition has immortalized Noah and the great ship, although the Quran is less certain of the location of the mountain where it landed, just referring to it as Al-Judi, the heights. Sometimes it's applied to Ararat or two other mountains in the Middle East. The book of Genesis gives an approximate location, stating the ark came to rest in the mountains of Ararat. The latter name is a derivative of Uratu, the name for ancient Armenia. But popular belief among the nations of the Ararat area, as well as among the majority of the spiritual descendants of the peoples of the book, as they're called, which includes Christians and Jews and Muslims, is the landing place of the ark was Mount Ararat. Maybe because it's the highest, most formidable, and most difficult to climb among the mountains of Armenia. Over the centuries, Mount Ararat, observed by travelers passing on horseback and mules and camel caravans to and from Inner Asia, have reported that they've observed a great ship sitting near the top of the mountain, or had spoken to the local people who said they'd not only seen it, but had been to it. Natives had even taken bits of pitch from the covering of the ark, from which they made amulets for protection against sickness and disaster, against being poisoned, or for success in love. Since the early 1800s, Ararat's been climbed by teams of mountaineers equipped with peak-scaling equipment, quadrants, height indicators, and cameras. Now, these expeditions haven't found any definite wreck of a huge ship on the mountains, other than ship-like shadows under the glaciers or beams of worked wood in or under the ice near the summit. The belief has grown the ark has slipped down the mountain and has fallen or descended into a great crevice, deeply frozen into one of the several glaciers that flow around Ararat. Now, the presence of an ancient ship on the summit of Ararat or any other high mountain would seem to be solely a survival of an ancient legend combined with a religious and moral message for succeeding generations. Looking at the mountain from the plains or foothills and reflecting on the fascinating story of Noah and the ark, it's easy to see or perhaps imagine that one sees the shape of a ship in the serrated formations of the ridges, a long oval shape in the gorges, or an unexplained black rectangular spot among the glaciers. But the many persons who reported seeing a ship on Ararat, especially in the last 200 years, weren't looking for it from afar, and sometimes from high up in the mountain, or according to their reports, in the immediate proximity of a part of a huge ship, the greater portion of which extended back into the glacial ice. Now, the paradox of how a ship could survive for thousands of years on top of a mountain isn't insoluble. First, we accept the theory of a great flood, tidal waves that washed over the plains and valleys and mountains of the earth, bearing with it the wreckage of a destroyed civilization. The Ark of Ararat would be one survivor of this flood, as may have been the case with other ships of rescue referred to in all ancient prehistoric cultures and mankind's oldest common legend. As I talked about the other day, in almost every single culture, there is the story of a great flood that wiped out civilization. You know, the story of the flood is worldwide, as is the story of survival, excuse me, by ship of a man and a woman. Excuse me. I don't know why I suddenly have developed this cold. You know, the story of survival of this favored man and woman usually talks about other family members or followers together with animals and plants for the renewal of life in a devastated world. It's only the name of knowing the kind of animals you took with them that varies in the many parts of the planet where the legend has been preserved. The local stories so resemble each other that when the Spanish first came to the New World, they found the civilized Indian nations as well as the forest tribes already familiar with the story of the flood. Some of the conquistadors consider this familiarity with Christian religion's tradition to simply be a trick of the devil to cause confusion among true believers. That an event of such magnitude as a worldwide flood should be remembered by surviving generations is frankly understandable. But the legend of a great wooden ship surviving for thousands of years, outlasting great cities and entire civilizations is, well, that beggars the imagination, frankly. As wood and iron and copper and brick and steel and all building material except huge stones vanish with time, how could a wooden ship maintain its recognizable shape on a mountaintop, exposed to the elements? Well, there is one explanation for this, how this ship could survive if it were frozen in the ice. Now, the summit of Ararat, the glacier between the two peaks and inner folds of the deep glaciers moving down its flanks, are old enough for preserving a craft made of heavy timber and caulked, in the words of Genesis, within and without with pitch. The occasional sightings by climbers and airborne pilots of a ship-like object on Ararat have invariably indicated a section of a great barge with the main part retreating into and under the ice, or sometimes just a shadow under the ice that appears to follow the lines of a ship with the approximate dimensions of the ark as detailed in Genesis. Now, one might suggest that both of these above possibilities are essentially the same if one considers climate variations. Every 20 years or so, an especially hot spell affects the Ararat region, and it's usually at these times, especially during the normally hot months of August and early September, that sightings of the ship have been reported. While the object remains under the ice, it stays impervious to decay, just as extinct animals like the mammoths of Siberia and the saber-toothed tigers and Pleistocene mammals found in Alaska and northern Canada, which have been dug out of the ice, complete with their fur and skin, and with undigested food from a pre-glacial age still in their stomachs. But since snow and ice rarely recede from certain areas of Mount Ararat, explorers may have climbed over vestiges of a great ship and not realized it. If the ship is still on the mountain deep under the snow and ice, prolonged and specialized investigation would be needed, which is difficult to accomplish on a mountain so dangerous to climb that for centuries local superstition had held it to be supernaturally protected from climbers searching for the Ark. Now, this assumed protection covers a multitude of dangers: avalanches, sudden rock slides, violent electrical storms, and high winds near the summit. Fast-forming fogs disorient climbers and often lead them to snow-covered or lightly frozen areas over deep crevices, which subsequently become their tombs. There are a number of living dangers as well. Poisonous snakes near the bottom of the mountain and continuing upward, wolf packs, and wild dogs, bears that preempt caves where a climber might seek shelter from time to time, and quite recently, Kurdish insurgents. And all this might have suggested to would-be explorers in the mountain that some had been put off limits by even higher forces than they ever watched for local gendarmes. But the searches have interrupted their efforts. The search for the ship on Ararat continues, and frankly intensifies every year. During the months of the late summer, when much of the ice has melted, because the prize, the discovery of the major section of the Ark, so often reported by climbers on the mountain or observers from the air, is incalculable. It modifies our concept of ancient history, reassess the geological history of the world, and reaffirm the traditional religious beliefs of a great section of the world's people. In this aspect, the Ark becomes timeless, affecting the future as well as the past. It raises many more questions than it would ever answer. But at the same time, it raises so many more questions. And, of course, more questions than it could ever answer. Now, you know, many of the historical references to sightings of a ship on Ararat are seen as seen from the ground have been made by observers visiting cities that have a view of the mountain. And other sightings have been recorded by travelers who moved slowly across the Anatolian plain in caravans as they journeyed to and from Persia, Armenia, and the Tartar lands in the north, which are now part of Russia. In ancient medieval times, when faith was stronger and men less skeptical, the presence of Noah's Ark on Ararat was generally accepted as an actuality. Therefore, as travelers passed by the mountains, their guides would customarily point out places on the slope or the summit where Noah's Ark might still be seen. In the clear light of early morning before the clouds cover the summit, or in the dusk when the clouds are gone and the black shapes of the crest appear against the rose-colored or violet sky of early evening, it becomes easy for a believer or even an imaginative non-believer to discern the outlines of a great ship sitting on the heights. And although there exists a great number of references to the Ark in ancient or medieval history, some of them refer to particulars that later became familiar to modern searches for the Ark. Berossus, a Babylonian historian, writing in 275 BC, referred to the ship that grounded in Armenia and mentioned the custom of local residents who obtained pitch from the ship by scraping it off and using it for amulets. And this same piece of information intrigued the Jewish historian Flavius Josephus, writing in the 1st century during the Roman occupation of Judea. In retelling the story of Noah and the flood, he wrote a portion of the vessel still remains in Armenia. Persons carry off pieces of the bitumen, which they use as talismans. And a tradition of the late Middle Ages recommended that the pitch be ground into powder and dissolved into a beverage to be drunk to preserve he who drank it from poison. You know, references to pitch and bitumen by these and other ancient writers are of interest, not only because they're in agreement with Genesis, but also because they indicate access to the huge ship in the intervening centuries and offer an explanation as to why some worked beams and timbers found high on the mountains under the ice may have been well preserved. Flavius Josephus included an interesting note in his History of the Jews. He said the Armenians called this place the place of descent, for the Ark being saved in that place, its remains are shown there by the inhabitants to this day. Nicolaus of Damascus, who wrote Universal History in the 1st century AD, refers to Mount Ararat as Baris. There is in Armenia, he said, a great mountain called Baris, where many refugees found safety at the time of the flood, and one man, transported on an ark, grounded on the summit, relics of the timbers were long preserved. Now, Baris, it seems, was another name for the present Mount Ararat, which in Armenia is referred to as Massis, the mother of the world. Nicolaus exhibits a somewhat scholarly reticence to jump into conclusions when he makes the comment, "This might be the same man of which Moses, the Jewish legislator, wrote." One of the most famous travelers of history passed by Ararat in the last part of the 15th century. This was the renowned Marco Polo on his way to the court of the Great Khan in Cathay. In his book, The Travels of Marco Polo, he made an intriguing reference to the Ark. He said, "You must know it's in this country of Armenia that the Ark of Noah exists on top of a certain great mountain, on the summit of which snow is so constant that no one can ascend. For the snow never melts, and it's constantly added to by new snowfalls. Below, however, the snow does melt and runs down, producing such rich and abundant herbage that in summer cattle are sent to pasture from a long roundabout way, and it never fails." Now, Marco Polo's description fits Mount Ararat, except for the statement that no one can ascend it. Important point that the snow and ice melts on the bottom and runs into the glaciers is especially noteworthy since it's been in certain crevasses under the glaciers that modern investigators have found ancient handwork beams and timbers. Now, a German visitor to the area in the early 17th century, Adam Oschlager, observes in his book Voyages and Travels of the Ambassadors, "The Armenians and the Persians themselves are of the opinion there are still on the mountain some remainders of the Ark, but that time has so hardened them they seem to be absolutely petrified." Sir John Mandeville saw the mountain in 1356 and dazzled by its sheer height. Most apparent in the early morning before the clouds hid the summit was one of the first observers to attempt an estimate of its height. He said, "A mountain called Ararat, where Noah's ship rested, and still is upon that mountain, and men see it afar in clear weather. The mountain is a full 7 miles high," he said. Now, Oschlager's, going back to something he wrote, mentions of the petrification of the timbers fits in with actual timbers brought back from the treeless glacial slopes of the mountain, which now can be seen in a monastery, and also resemble pieces that aren't. Excuse me. Brought back in modern times by the French explorer mountaineer Fernand Navarra, and further remains discovered by other explorers. I mean, there's concrete backup for the belief by these people that, in fact, there is a ship on Ararat. Now, Ararat's actually 17,011 feet high. And this, let's call it over-enthusiasm, tends to minimize Sir John's observations of Mount Ararat. It is understandable, though, when one takes into account Ararat's sudden and awe-inspiring appearance when the crowds lift. Dr. John Montgomery in The Quest for Noah's Ark suggests that Mandeville may have been calculating the distance from the foothills to the top of the peak, which would be about 7 miles. The many writers of antiquity in the Middle Ages who described Ararat apparently didn't feel called upon to attempt to climb up its sides, facing its glaciers, precipices, rock slides, and avalanches, to find out firsthand whether or not the Ark was still there. In their day, it wasn't really necessary. Religious faith, before the era of doubt, which initiated the modern age, needed no reaffirmation, and in addition, there was always the threat of divine interdiction against profaning that holy vessel. You know, the Christian population of Europe and the Middle East from the days of the Byzantine Empire firmly believed the Ark was on Mount Ararat, and later teachings of Islam reinforced the belief in the flood, the Ark, and Noah, and that the Ark would only be revealed by God on a day of judgment. Franciscan friar by the name of Oderic, he was later to report back to the papal court at Avignon, saw the mountain in 1316 and said the folk in the country told us no one could ever ascend the mountain for this has seemed not to be the pleasure of the Most High. Now, Oderic himself, alone among ancient or medieval commentators, was thoroughly unimpressed by the sheer height of the mountain. More than 400 years before the first recorded ascent, he wrote, "I would have ascended it if my companions would have waited for me." And the belief in the Ark was then, and often is now, an article of faith. Some Byzantine churchmen referred to the Ark as proof of the church teachings. John Chrysostom, a 4th century patriarch of Constantinople, asked questions to which he thought the answers were simply evident. "Let us therefore ask they don't, who don't believe, have you heard of the flood, of the universal destruction?" That was not just a threat, was it? Did it not really come to pass? Was not this mighty work carried out? Are not the remains of the ark preserved there to this very day for our admonition? And Bishop Apenius of Salamis asked, do you seriously suppose we're unable to prove our point, when even to this day the remains of Noah's ark are shown in the country of the Kurds? Now, he wrote in the 4th century, and this 4th century reference to the Kurds suggests they were already established around the mountain along with the Armenians at a very early date. Now, the Armenians are gone, mainly concentrated in the Armenian part of the Russia and in communities within the U.S. The Kurds still live in the Mount Ararat area and from time to time engage in raids and warfare against local governments and Kurdish-populated areas in the Middle East. The legend of God's prohibition against man ascending Ararat has lasted until fairly modern times. Dr. Frederick Parrott, a German professor of natural philosophy at Dorpat University in Estonia, which was then part of Imperial Russia, made the first official climb to the summit in 1829. Gave his name to the Parrott Glacier that flows northwest down the mountain. He observed of his Russian and Armenian climbing companions are all firmly persuaded that the Ark remains to this day on the top of Mount Ararat, and in order to ensure its preservation, no human being is allowed to approach it. Now, previous to his climb, Parrott spent some time at St. Jacob's Monastery at Ahura on the northwest side of the mountain, was shown by the abbot some wood that came from the Ark, which had been made into an icon. However, the monastery, the monks, and the village of Aurora disappeared in 1840 during Mount Ararat's last volcanic eruption that buried the monastery, the village, and left a precipitous gorge where the buildings had been. Dr. Hermann Abich, another German professor of mineralogy, also from the University of Dorpat, climbed Ararat in 1845. Now, his name has been immortalized in the two Abich glaciers, one of which noisily emptied its waters into the Aurora Gorge on the northeast side of the mountain that looks towards Russia. And although he wasn't specifically looking for the Ark, one of his reasons for climbing the mountain was a curious one, suggested by I. Spassky Avantimov, another of the early climbers. They both wanted to ascertain whether the stars and planets are visible during the day from extremely high mountaintops. Now, prior to the modern investigations that started in the 1820s, there had been a number of hearsay or legendary accounts of ascents to the upper regions of Ararat and the sighting or touching of the Ark. Now, these accounts concern visits to the Ark by holy men looking for sacred relics, herders searching for lost animals from their flocks, or collectors of wood or pitch from the ship at a time when the Ark was presumably more accessible, as it possibly was before the last earthquake and the eruption of Mount Ararat in 1840. Now, there have been various considered either as miracles or unusual exploits. In one case, a shepherd told of finding a great cliff in the heights while he was searching for lost sheep. As he got closer to this cliff, it turned out to be the side of an enormous ship partially covered by ice and snow. Well, fearing he had committed sacrilege, he fled in fear of punishment. But in former times as now, shepherds have tended to avoid the extreme heights as a place of sickness and death, not realizing the sickness was actually what's called mountain sickness, which is caused by altitude. They recognized the danger zone as the point where the sheep began to die and feel understandably they've frankly gone far enough. According to tradition, one Byzantine prelate attempted to climb to the Ark. This was a monk, Jacob of Mesbin, later Bishop of Nisibis, and finally he became a saint. After a long series of prayers to God he'd be allowed to see the Ark, he started a long climb up the west side of Mount Ararat. Tormented by thirst and overcome by fatigue, he lay down to rest. When he woke up, he found a spring had miraculously appeared near where he was lying. This spring, now called Jacob's Well, is still there and serves as a landmark on the mountain. He later continued his climb, but after each rest, he would find upon waking he was once again at the point where he had started. Presumably, he believed he was carried down the mountain by angels.
Well, God finally granted his prayer and sent an angel to visit him. The angel told Jacob to cease his attempts to climb the forbidden mountain and gave him a piece of the ark. The angel then informed Jacob the ark was forbidden territory for mankind until such time as God himself should choose to reveal it. Sir John Chardon, an early observer of Mount Ararat and commenting on this miracle in 1356, observed, instead of it being a miracle that no one could ever reach the top, I would rather deem it a great miracle if somebody did reach the top. From its halfway point to the peak, it's perpetually covered with snow, so that at all seasons it has the appearance of a vast heap of snow. A British ascent was made to the top of Ararat in 1856 by a group led by a veteran of the Crimean War, Major Robert Stuart. During his climb, he found his Kurdish guides came to a halt at a certain place and refused to go any further, alleging that in justification, ancestral tradition, and fear of treading on holy ground. And said that the scale of the mountain is impossible, and any attempt at this kind would be followed by the immediate displeasure of heaven. Well, when several members of the British party reached the summit, some among them reluctant Kurds, as reported by Major Stuart, exclaimed, "We'd always thought that Allah had made the holy mountain inaccessible to man. Many have tried to ascend it, and no one's ever succeeded till you came, and without any preparation, walked straight up from the base to the top. Allah be praised. We've heard strange things of you, but now we see them with our own eyes." Well, the major accepted this accolade with, excuse me, typical British aplomb, reported in an entry worthy of the best tradition of the empire, and said, "Then indeed they began to feel the force of what we asserted, that many things forbidden to the Kurds are allowed to the English. They're favored by God," in other words. Well, the northeast part of Turkey is a frequent scene of earthquakes and has been so throughout recorded history. An especially violent earthquake occurred June of 1840 and completely demolished the town of Arguri, or Ahura, located on the northeast side of the Ararat. The earthquake and eruption of Mount Ararat killed all of the inhabitants and destroyed the Armenian monastery of St. Jacob, once visited by Parrott and other travelers. It was reputed to contain a number of ancient records pertaining to the ark, as well as actual pieces of the ark. The event left a deep gorge at the melting end of the Black Glacier, so-called because of the covering of black dust coming from the crushed, shattered rocks. This drop-off, almost 800 feet of sheer cliff, is called the Aurora Gorge, and at the bottom of the gorge, water collects from the seasonally melting bottom of the 600-foot-thick glacier directly above the gorge. It would seem normal to suppose if the ark had really survived thousands of years on the mountain, it would either have been exposed by the seismic disaster of 1840 or been itself demolished. But subterranean, submarine, or subglacial results of an earthquake are rarely predictable, and a reported discovery of the ark by Turkish authorities was not made public until the summer of 1883, when a new earthquake that had shaken the mountain had demolished a number of villages. The Turkish commissioners, including an attaché of the British Embassy at Istanbul, which was then called Constantinople, were assessing the damages and changes when they reported it came upon a huge wooden boat-like structure. Painted brown, made of heavy timber, some of which were broken, at the end of it emerged from the bottom of an overhanging glacier. The commissioners estimated the height of the object to be 50 feet, its length the equivalent of 300 cubits, reported that they actually entered that ship-like structure. They were able to penetrate three large compartments, but the other sections were filled with solid ice. After reassessing their situation, they prudently decided to abandon the investigation of their find because of the possibility that the huge glacial overhang might collapse on the ship and trap them as well. This report concerning the ark first appeared in the press of Constantinople and soon thereafter in the Levant Herald and the British Prophetic Messenger. But instead of awakening scientific or archaeological interest in the ark legend, it furnished the American press with an item already made for the kind of reporting reserved for UFO stories of a later day. The New York Herald noted that since a British officer was among the discoverers, the height of the stalls on board the presumed vessel was in accord with the specifications of British Admiralty for horse transport, and therefore not open to doubt. As for the length of the craft, 300 cubits, the nation has seriously thought of a ship, railway, across Central America cannot doubt that the ark can be brought to deep water. Adding that when such a thing happened and the ark reaches American waters, the Navy Department ought to purchase her at once, for the world's greatest republic ought to have at least one ship that wouldn't rot as soon as it leaves the Navy Yard. Well, an article in the Chicago Tribune reported that the inhabitants in the vicinity of Ararat had noted the great structure of dark wood for some years, but had been afraid to go near it because a spirit of fierce aspect has been seen looking out the windows. The official party had stated it recognized the ark immediately, since there was an Englishman among them who was presumably read his Bible, and he saw it was made of the ancient gopher wood of scripture. Well, the gratuitous the quip was considered gratuitous, since gopher wood still hadn't been satisfactorily identified. The feature writer of the New York World changed the nationality exploring party to Russians and then compared the finding of the Ark to the famous Cardiff Giant hoax. He added, the reader mustn't be surprised if he learns from the latest dispatches from our representative, Mr. Benjamin, the engineers have broken through the third compartment of the Ark and, in the true spirit of the age, have discovered the original law kept by Noah and his sons. Well, keep in mind that even in this early period of a journalistic endeavor, you had fake news, just as CNN is so famous for. As in the case of the Today's Press reporting on UFO sightings, no follow-ups appear in the newspapers. The entire incident was more or less forgotten, except for the reader's impression that something of a hoax had been perpetrated. It was in this atmosphere that another series of curious incidents took place only 4 years after the reported post-earthquake discovery. This time it concerned a report made to the World Parliament of Religion meeting in Chicago in 1893 by John Joseph, Prince of Nuri, who held, among numerous other titles, that of Archbishop and Grand Apostolic Ambassador of Malabar, India, and Persia. Prince Nuri stated at the meeting he had reached the Ark during his explorations in 1887 to ascertain the source of the Euphrates. He claimed to have climbed Mount Ararat 3 times, succeeding on the 3rd attempt. He described the Ark as being more than 100 feet high and 300 yards long, with one end broken off. Following the considerable publicity caused by his statements, he undertook to organize an expedition to Mount Ararat and to lead it to the point where the Ark was lying, and there to disassemble the Ark for easier transportation and reassemble it for exhibition at the then-current Chicago World's Fair. To this end, he successfully involved a group of investors, but the enterprise was halted almost at its inception, since Turkish permission for the undertaking was denied. Prince Nuri's career further complicated by his being mugged while on a trip to San Francisco and a resultant stay in a mental hospital came to an untimely end in the early 1900s, leaving unresolved further verification of his discovery of the Ark. The difficulty of proving the existence of a ship on or near the summit of Ararat has been compounded by the lack of photographs and contemporaneous corroboration from other witnesses. A number of reports of individual visits to the Ark in the 19th century didn't surface until after the second decade of the 20th century, when a striking event concerning the Ark occurred during World War I. A variety of contemporary and corroborative reports of this incident and subsequent ramifications are still making the rounds, and even now new information continues to pop up. An unusual sighting of the Ark, and perhaps the most celebrated, occurred in the summer of 1916. During the thaw of that year, made by Lieutenant Roskovitsky and his co-pilot while flying an observation airplane for the Russian Imperial Air Force. Their orders were to accomplish altitude tests and to observe Turkish troop movements during a time when the Russian armies are being hard-pressed on several fronts. Their small air base was located about 25 miles northeast of Mount Ararat. Roskovitsky and his co-pilot, equipped with oxygen tanks for high-altitude breathing, approached Ararat from the northeast, circled it twice, and as he got closer, Roskovitsky noticed a half-frozen lake on a shelf or gully on the side of the mountain, similar to those glacial concentrations which increase or decrease in size according to seasonal glacial melting. When they got nearer, the co-pilot pointed to something near the lake's overflow, and Roskovitsky realized that he was looking what appeared to be a half-submerged hull of some sort of huge ship. Now, at first, he thought it might be a submarine, unconsciously attributing it to the Germans, masters of submarine warfare, the ability to launch a submarine within a lake while on the up on the side of a massive mountain. But then he noticed what first he took for periscopes were two stubby masts that the ship, which it apparently was leaning on one side into the ice. And then he noticed a flat catwalk down the length of the top of the ship. In Roscovitsky's words from the New Eden magazine from California in 1939, we flew down as close as safety permitted and took several circles around it. We were surprised when we got close to it at the immense size of the thing, because it was as long as a city block. We compare very favorably in size to the modern battleships of today. Grounded on the shore of the lake, about one-fourth underwater. It had been partly dismantled on one side near the front, and on the other side there was a great doorway nearly 20 feet square, but with the other door gone. Seemed quite out of proportions, as even today ships seldom have doors even half that large. After this somewhat cursory examination, Roscovitsky returned to his base and informed the base commander, a captain, of what he had seen. The captain was understandably impressed and told Roscovitsky to take him back to the site and told him after seeing it that what he had flown over was Noah's Ark, explaining its survival by the supposition that it was frozen up for 9 or 10 months of the year. It couldn't rot and been in cold storage, as it were, all this time. Well, the captain forwarded a report back to St. Petersburg with the result that orders came from the Tsar to send two engineer companies up the mountain. One group of 50 men attacked one side and the other group of 100 men attacked the mountain from the other side. 2 weeks of hard work are required to chop a trail along the cliffs of the lower part of the mountain nearly a month before the Ark was reached. That the imperial government ordered the Tsar should it send specialized troops to climb up Mount Ararat during a time they needed elsewhere raises the possibility of a psychological operation planned to give the Russian army and people a spiritual uplift and indications of divine protection in the dark days prior to the February revolution that overthrew the Tsar. The Germans had previously attempted religio-psychological operations, including powerful airborne magic lanterns projecting onto cloud banks over the German lines. Pictures of the Holy Family and Russian saints who seemed to hover protectively over the German trenches. So you have to ask yourself, what was the purpose of the Tsar sending troops he needed up Mount Ararat? Complete measurements were taken and plans drawn of it, as well as many photographs, all of which were sent to the Tsar. According to a magazine article, the Ark was found to contain hundreds of small rooms, and some rooms are very large with high ceilings. The unusually large rooms had a fence of great timbers across them, some of which were 2 feet thick, which is as if designed to hold beasts 10 times the size of elephants. Other rooms were also lined with tiers of cages, somewhat like one sees today at a poultry show. And only instead of chicken wire, they had rows of small iron bars along the front. Well, the writer of the article, by mentioning beasts 10 times as large as elephants, tend to destroy his credibility. If, on the other hand, the Roscovitsky story, written long after the event, is a compendium of a variety of witnesses, pilots, soldiers, engineers, etc., that's understandable exaggeration should occur. But then again, we don't know what animals may have been on the Ark, because we haven't seen every animal that exists on this planet. Everything is heavily painted with a wax-like paint resembling shellac, and the workmanship of the craft showed all the signs of a high type of civilization. The wood used throughout was oleander. It belongs to the cypress family and never rots, which, of course, coupled with the fact of it being frozen most of the time, accounted for its perfect preservation. Now, this description seems so close to the biblical description that André Parent, a French writer on the Ark and the Flood, dismissed Roscovitsky's account with the comment, "It's most unfortunate that no competent person saw this report. Lost during the course of the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. All we have is Roscovitsky's story, of which at least that can be said is that that if it is shorn of reminiscences of Genesis, scarcely, excuse me, anything is left." That didn't prevent several American periodicals from claiming the sensational news. Serious specialized organs reserved for it the fate it deserved. Silence. You know, the expedition found in the peak of the mountain above the ship the remains of the timbers that were missing out of one side of it. Seems the timbers had been hauled up to the top of the mountain and used to build a shrine. Now, this mention of a shrine is a especially intriguing feature of the Roskovitsky account in that it seems to explain why separate timbers had been found at different points at the highest levels of the mountain, thousands of feet above the tree line. If during the thousands of years the ship had been on the mountain and been visited by occasional pilgrims at a time when it was more visible, more accessible, some of them would probably have constructed a shrine at or near the summit made out of the ark's wood in remembrance, perhaps, of the traditional altar built by Noah immediately after the flood. Ratzkovitsky's published account breaks off rather abruptly, simply stating the investigating officer sent photographs and reports by courier back to Petrograd to the personal attention of the Tsar. But Nicholas II apparently never received them during the breakdown of communications that followed the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. The results of the investigation have either never been found or never been reported. A rumor exists the results of the investigation and the pictures of the ark came to the attention of Leon Trotsky, who either destroyed them or placed them in a file destined to be kept permanently secret. According to the same rumor, the special courier's silence on the matter was also permanently secured by his execution. Remember, one of the main tenets of the Bolshevik belief system was that there was no God. If there was no God, God, of course, didn't save Moses, and the Ark and the Flood were fairy tales. Now, Ruskovitsky's account ends with the simple statement, he and several other pilots escaped the Bolsheviks. The Armenian eventually arrived in America. An enigma and stumbling block to the acceptance of this much-published report lies in the identity of Ruskovitsky, known survivor of the Imperial Army, the Air Force, and the Ararat area at that time, remembers any Lieutenant Ruskovitsky. And that would seem to indicate he never existed, or at that time that he wrote the magazine article, even though it was 22 years after his discovery of the Ark, he's unwilling to use his own name for reasons of self-protection, even in America. Keep in mind that while you wouldn't think it initially, being the person that discovered Noah's Ark could, in fact, place your life in jeopardy. Nevertheless, there's been considerable recollection among individual Russian Army survivors who were involved in operations during that period and in that locale. Errol Cummings, an outstanding researcher of the Ark legend for more than 40 years and a veteran of 25 ascents of Ararats, was able to make personal contact with the Colonel Alexander Kuhr, author of an article about the incident printed in 1945 in Russia, which oversees an overseas Russian magazine. In New York, Colonel Kuhr had been in command of the 19th Petropavlovsky Regiment, stationed near Mount Ararat 1915-1916, with the mission of protecting the Aratsky Pass at a time when the Turkish forces made a partial breakthrough in the Russian lines. He remembered having heard of the reputed finding of the Ark and gave pertinent information to it in a certified interview with Ark researcher Cummings. Kuhr stated it was his opinion that the pilot who viewed the Ark was First Lieutenant Zablotsky, and the captain's name not given in the original article was Kurbatov. Kablotsky, according to Colonel Kuhr, sighted the Ark and started the investigation. Kuhr had spoken to a Lieutenant Petro Leslin in 1921 who informed him that he, Leslin, had heard about the discovery not as a rumor but as news told to him by a senior adjutant of his division, and that Noah's Ark is found in the saddle of the two peaks of Ararat. Kuhr also supplied information about the latter visit to the Ark by the engineer battalion, which he received from Boris Rujansky, a family friend who in 1916-1917 was a sergeant in the military railroad battalion, then stationed near Dolgubayadze, located several miles from Ararat and through which the railroad formerly passed. Sergeant Rujansky had actually taken part in the investigation and corroborated the ascent of the battalion to the heights of Mount Ararat. Now, the Kuhr account was more complete than the Ruskovitsky article in that it specified that one of the two investigating expeditions who climbed Ararat by following an existing trail. At one point, they found that their climb had led them to a place where they were looking down on a huge ship, which had one end underwater. The other unit that arrived there first didn't follow a trail, but had to cut steps in the ice as they climbed. When this unit reached the ship, a number of the soldiers crossed themselves, some falling on their knees in prayer before entering it. Inside the Ark, according to the Corps article, there were partitions. It appeared there were also rust marks on the floor, presumably from the iron rods that marked the rusted iron bars of many small and large partitions. Now, despite persistent efforts by Cummings, Dr. John Montgomery, who wrote The Quest for Noah's Ark, was also interviewed Colonel Corr in 1970. And the official reports and photographs referred to in several versions of the 1916 discovery of the Ark have never surfaced in public view. But a number of interviews and statements have, including the separate testimonies of individual Russian soldiers who, during a maneuver around Mount Ararat in the summer of 1917, remembered seeing a wooden structure shaped like a ship several hundred feet above them as they marched by. Soldiers noticed at one end of the object they saw it back into the snow and ice of the mountain. So that does seem to give confirmation that, in fact, there was a ship on Ararat. Another unusual legend was current among the Russian officers and their families. That was that several members of the imperial family had escaped the massacre at Ekaterinburg in 1918 and been spirited away through a network of monasteries and convents to safety in other countries. Now, a number of people had personal recollections of conversations with refugee Russian officers in Paris in the mid-1920s, officers who had left the Caucasus area with refugees from the armies of General Denikin, one of the last generals who held out against the communists until there was no hope but to retreat over the border and escape. And several of these officers had been active in Turkey and still remembered hearing a report about the finding of the Ark on Ararat. Story had been told and retold through the armies on the southern front, but was overshadowed by the fall of the dynasty and the disintegration of the imperial armies. Now, the legend of the members of the imperial family escaping has occurred in various occasions in the stormy history of imperial Russia. Russian history has witnessed a number of pretenders to the crown, false czars or false heirs to the throne, whose putative identity is usually settled by their defeat and execution. It is only natural that such legends have subsisted in regard to the last imperial family and certain survivors, notably Anastasia, the youngest imperial princess, as well as the Tsarevich, have been the subject of a number of books published in Great Britain and the United States. One alleged Tsarevich, bearing the same name as the son of the last Tsar, Alexei Nikolaevich Romanov, and considered so by a number of people, and was alive until May of 1986 and living in Phoenix, Arizona, of all places. Now, there were a number of telephone conversations between Alexei Nikolaevich Romanov and various writers. It's pointed out that Mr. Romanov was the same age as Tsarevich would have been had he survived and was in poor health at the time of the interview. And he was asked, "Do you remember hearing about Noah's Ark being found on Mount Ararat in 1916? He said, "Yes, I remember hearing talk about the discovery. A ship was seen lying on top of the mountain by aviators." He asked who talked about it. And he said, "I heard it from his father, the Tsar, and people were talking about it in the palace. Do you remember your father, the emperor, saying he had sent an expedition to the place where the Ark was found?" He said, "Yeah, something along those lines. His father consulted with the Duma." That was their version of Congress. And he said, "I think the Duma made the decision. Army officers had reported it. The army was in Turkey then. I remember my father saying there was an expedition was sent." "Was that the Russian army in the Caucasus under the command of Grand Duke Nikolai Nikolovich?" He said, "That was my uncle. You know, he's almost 7 feet tall. He used to carry me sometimes. I used to see him at Sarkoye-Selo. That's north of Petrograd. I don't remember much. I was very sick." Well, the memories that I just outlined were offered by the person that wrote them as a possible collaboration of the expedition to the Ark from somebody who considered himself the son of Russia's last emperor, may have been, or maybe he was a relative. Other reminiscences from individuals who were in the imperial court in Petrograd and made similar statements about what they remembered having heard discussed. There doesn't seem to be much doubt that an expedition was sent. And the reports, if in fact they fell into Bolshevik hands,
would have been either destroyed or suppressed. Though today, there's the possibility they could be found. There are also memories among the Kurds and the Turks. Mustafa, former herdsman now living in Dogubayazit, and whose present activities are centered around visits to the mosque and tea houses, is now over 85 years old. He was interviewed in August of 1985 in order to ascertain if he'd ever heard about the Russian expedition to find the Ark. According to him, I remember there one thing very well. My father was working on a railroad the Russians were repairing. He said what people worked in the work teams. The teams had Russians and Turks and Kurds. He was asked, did the teams hear anything about the Russian expedition? He said, by Allah, one day everybody did. It was in late summer one afternoon. We heard a great noise of shooting and yelling hurrah by the Russians. In the village, it was thought it was a battle because the Russians always yelled hurrah in attacks. Then his father came running in. He remembered it was early for him to come home. He said it was no battle, but the Russians were drinking bottles of vodka and firing off rifles, revolvers, and one machine gun. He said the head of the team said to the workers, don't you know what happened on the mountain? They found the Ark, the team that was sent by the Tsar himself. It's a great day of joy for the Russians. Well, Mustafa said the Kurds always thought the Ark was on Agri Dago, but did not think the Russians would find it. But they found it near Lake Kup. But the Russians left after a while, and the Ark is still there. The Ruskovitsky account and the corroborative statements from a variety of sources have understandably been discounted as lacking in essential proof, such as photographs, official reports, or certified substantiations. And it's fruitless for defenders of these reports to point out the disappearance of records and photographs to be a natural result of the ensuing revolution and civil war in Russia. Another influential factor would be the change in the religious temperament of the Russian people. For one of the most religious empires to an officially anti-religious association of republics, the situation makes any investigation of a religious nature difficult, or even any investigation of an archaeological nature connected with religion. Americans are exploring Mount Ararat in search of the Ark, as well as flights of American aircraft in the vicinity of Mount Ararat meet with suspicion and often protest from the Soviet side of the border, where the impression is evident that Russian explorers have used the search for spying activities. If there's any doubt, there's always the accusations the CIA's involved. But whether the Ruskovitsky report was true, false, or partially true, it's generated on its own the most definite source in centuries toward a reappraisal of the Ark legend. It is noteworthy it was only after 1916-1917 that a number of sightings of the Ark previous to 1916 became public. And these have included a number of personal visits to the Ark, the bringing back of work planks and timbers found in high altitudes where there is no wood, and even deathbed confessions from one person who'd been afraid to tell of his experiences, and others had attempted to discredit the Ark's existence after seeing it. Many of the subsequent visits to Ararat have been encouraged and inspired by other sightings from the air during the period between the wars and during World War II and after that. As far as can be ascertained, none of these air probes, military aircraft, helicopters, satellites, or space shuttles have been looking for the Ark, but in some cases have come across it unexpectedly or have found a ship-like profile outlined in a photograph. Photographs from the air, from space, have reportedly shown a great ship on the side of the mountain, but no definite or identifiable photograph of a wooden ship on Ararat has yet been made available to the public. Keep in mind that even though this is all done with public funds, the American people are not worthy to be made aware of the findings of its military. During the military supply operation between the USA and the USSR in World War II, considerable air traffic developed between the main U.S. base in Tunisia and the Russian base at Erevan in the Armenian Republic. During 1943, two American pilots flying near Mount Ararat thought they saw something resembling the outline of a great ship thousands of feet below them. Retracing the earlier flight, they were accompanied by an air group photographer who took a picture of it. Subsequently, published according to a number of witnesses on the front page of the Mediterranean edition of Stars and Stripes. That's the U.S. Armed Forces newspaper.
Stars and Stripes photos, only one of a number of pictures allegedly taken under the Ark during World War II by U.S., Australian, and especially Russian airmen. A number of people remember seeing them, but the photographs share a common feature. They can't be found. Some Russian pilots have reportedly shown pictures of a large ship on an ice-covered mountain to Allied airmen during the period of the munitions airlift from the south, alleging it was a photograph of the Ark, but the Russian pilots in all cases refused to let the pictures out of their hands, an understandable refusal considering the active anti-religious policy of the Soviet regime. And the photographs taken by American pilots also seem to have vanished, even the one published by Stars and Stripes, lost somewhere among the old files of the Mediterranean editions of 1943. All things considered, it may be the Stars and Stripes photograph was a picture of a volcanic rock formation not on Ararat, but almost 25 miles away, which somewhat surprisingly does possess the approximately shape and dimensions of the Ark of Legend. A number of American pilots saw a ship-like construction protruding from the side of Mount Ararat in the late spring or summer of 1960. And these pilots were based in Adana, Turkey, with the 428th Tactical Flight Squadron under NATO's military assistance pact in effect at that time. The pilots have been told about the Ark by the Turkish liaison pilot assigned to them, and on several occasions have been guided past Mount Ararat on routine observation flights. These pilots didn't have time to make any successful photographs because of their haste to make a quick turn around the mountain before becoming an object of unusual interest by Russian observers on the Russia side of the border. Captain, then Second Lieutenant Gregor Swinghammer, now a commercial pilot, was interviewed in 1981 concerning a barge-like object he saw on Ararat, as described in Doomsday 1999 AD. He stated the Turkish liaison officer that accompanied him and another pilot on the counterclockwise swing around Mount Ararat in the course of which they saw an enormous boxcar, a rectangular barge visible in a gully high on the mountain. He specified it seemed to be banked, indicating it wasn't stationary but movable, and somehow had become caught there as it slid down the mountain. He remembered he'd later heard at the base club that some pictures had been taken of this object, reportedly by the U-2 pilots, prior to the unexpected sudden ending of the U-2 program when Gary Powers was brought down over the USSR and captured by the Soviets. It's interesting to note that the pilots used to talk about it in the bar after flying. Some of the pilots thought it was the Ark, others didn't know what to think. He wasn't convinced about it, but he knew he'd seen a large rectangular building like a barge or a ship high up on the mountain. Well, we've come to the end of another show. We'll be talking more about Noah's Ark tomorrow night. Till then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.